The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. In the news, embarrassing questions being put to theologians about the existence of God. And the theologians answer, well, you've got to fall back on faith or a personal experience. How many times have I read articles or books or magazines from theologians who say, you can't prove God's existence? How many times in an answer column in the newspaper will you see a statement to this effect when a nuclear physicist, a geologist, a paleontologist, or perhaps just an antagonist who has anti-supernaturalistic bias and wishes to try to unsettle or to in some way disturb the theologian says, yes, but what do you do in the event of the death of a child? Or what about caprice or accident in this universe or among humankind? What about wars? How do you explain sickness, blindness, deafness, and all types of disease? What about these horrible accidents? The theologian's answer? Well, usually he says, that is a good question. And then after he congratulates the person on the question, he says, actually, it's one of the hardest that a minister ever has to face. And then he will usually say, now, I do not pretend, covering himself, to have all the answers, and this is only my opinion, he will go on, but I feel that it's a matter of personal faith. And that since I have had a personal feeling, a sort of a personal notion or a personal experience in one way or another with a divine being, I feel, therefore, that there is a God. You know, that's been hitting the newspapers and the magazines recently, but isn't it about time some of the theologians ask some of the anti-supernaturalists and some of the atheists and the agnostics? I guess people wear that label. It means we're ignorant. We don't know. But isn't it about time they were asked some embarrassing questions? You know, the average person has simply never looked into the theory of evolution very much. Now, probably you have not. You wouldn't really know in a simple test how to define what evolution is. What does it purport? What does it claim? You may not know, for that matter, that the broad majority of scientists, and especially those that are dealing with the physical sciences, such as physics, and they go into all of the various special fields today of higher math, and those that are nuclear physicists that have to do with the American space program or other space projects of that nature, have not studied the biological sciences very much. It is all highly specialized. Now, I happen to know a man with a doctor's degree who worked in jet propulsion, and not only one, but a number. And they all tell you that it's quite specialized. But the idea is, among the natural or the physical sciences, that you don't question the carefully constructed ideas of paleontologists, of biologists, and geologists. This would be rank heresy. You don't question the book when you pick up a nice, thick volume that says North American Index Fossils, and you're maybe working for some oil company, and you're handling geologic surveys, you're out dynamiting, trying to find out about the possibility of oil in some area. You're not studying, you're not going to college to find out whether or not index fossils are in error. You're trying to learn about synclines and isoclines and geosynclines. You're trying to learn where would be the most logical place to find a lot of decayed bodies of reptiles so you can make them into ladies' nylons. Maybe you can put them into automobiles, gasoline tanks, and run engines with them. So you're not worried at all about trying to unsettle the very carefully collected geological phenomena. It would be a wearisome task to begin to investigate this in the first place. And as I've said time and again, you have never yet known of a paleontologist who went to college to learn what is wrong with paleontology. No, he went to get his degree, to study as fast as he possibly could, to achieve and acquire as much knowledge in that field as he could, to either go on into the teaching field or to take up a position in some very, maybe highly complex and technical field where he could use this knowledge that he had gleaned from his textbooks. It sounds like rank heresy to tell you that there is no single place on the face of this earth where the geologic column is complete in all of its elements. It sounds like rank heresy to have to tell you there is absolutely no proof whatsoever of the so-called fossil order of simple to complex, that there is not one place on the face of all this earth where all those fossils are present. It also would sound, I suppose, like the height of folly to tell you that it is a great stratigraphical law that any so-called older stratum, the way geologists and paleontologists label it, may be found resting completely conformably, looking like it was deposited there in that manner on top of any so-called younger stratum. And this occurs quite frequently in massive areas of the Earth's surface. Now, there is a tremendous anti-supernaturalistic bias in the minds of many people. And certainly the Noachian deluge, the flood of the Bible, has come in for its share of criticism and carping jokes. I think many theologians have felt they have to be backed into the corner by the geologists who claim that it had to be a local flood, and so they have gone along with that idea. And they've said, well, maybe it was a local flood. Maybe, after all, in a couple of thousand years, man just had not learned to migrate. Now, we know better than that. Some of those fellows probably tried to get away from their mothers-in-law just as much as you did. And I imagine that in that ancient valley, so-called cradle of civilization, that they would move hundreds of miles to accomplish just such a simple task as that. Now, we know better, but we don't give it that much thought. We don't seem to realize the ancient Phoenicians circumnavigated Africa, that they were mining tin in Cornwall and bringing rare birds and plants back from India, and there was no Suez Canal. We don't seem to realize the pre-flood world was an advanced world, and you can prove it, that their language was simpler than ours. That Babylonian cuneiform, far from being some kind of a laborious primitive language, was sort of like a shorthand, and that a scribe with a collection of tiny wedges could write much more rapidly than the average secretary can take shorthand today. But it's because we haven't studied it, and we probably just haven't found this out. Well, anyhow, a lot of the theologians have gone along with the idea that it had to be a local flood, so all God had to do, if it was God, and they like to keep God out of the picture to claim it was just a bad rain, was to drown a few people in one local valley area. Now, this is sort of funny when you put alongside what they claim about portions of the Swiss Alps, because many sections of the Swiss Alps are upside down. Now, bear with me. They're not really upside down, you see, but I mean that they do not conform to the carefully constructed geologic succession of strata. And therefore, the geologists claim they have to be upside down. It would not do to admit that they are, as any fool would be able to look at, you would think, billions of cubic yards of earth, and to see that it's probably just about the way it was placed there. And to accept it the way it is and to begin to question the theory instead. No, they begin to question the mountain, not the theory. Leave the theory alone. Let's see what we can do with that hill over there. So, they claim that vast sections of the Swiss Alps are overthrust faults and were moved there from North Africa. Now, this is real amazing. You see, in this anti-supernaturalistic bias is also rather amazing because they are determined that human beings, with all their ingenuity and all their mothers-in-law, would not migrate out of a valley a few hundred miles to some mountains and could not survive a flood, so as to admit that maybe if you want to straddle the fence between theology and science, you can admit that maybe the Noachian deluge did occur. Of course, you'd figure that maybe some of the historians blew it up all out of proportion, and maybe Noah was a little wrong when he sat back after that first drink of the juice of his vineyard and began to tell the story to his kids. So they think maybe it grew with the years. But they would have us believe human beings could not have migrated even a few hundred miles, but they would also have you believe that huge mountains were pushed 1,000 miles and more. Now, that doesn't sound quite fair somehow, but of course you might not have known that. You might not have studied it. It is amazing. How about that now, that you can move mountains from continent to continent to support carefully constructed theories of geologists, but you cannot have humans escape a local flood? Well, my friends, it's time you began to look into it and prove it to yourself, and nothing can be more thoroughly proved than the Noachian deluge, the flood during the time of Noah. Do you know that it was predicted back in 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter, centuries ago, that there would come this argument against divine revelation, that there would be a doctrine extant today in what is called in Bible language the latter days or the last times, that the flood did not occur, that people would just be very highly desirous of scoffing at the flood during Noah's day. Back in 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter, in the 3rd verse, the Apostle Peter said, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation, going according to cycles, going along to the swinging of the pendulum of the extremes of human nature. But, he said in verse 5, for this they willingly are ignorant of. They are willingly ignorant. Now, to be willingly ignorant, it means you're not going to admit into your mind anything that unsettles or nettles you. If it isn't something that appeals to you, it doesn't find its place in the nice orderly niche into which you would like to fit it. And you always view everything in the perspective of your past experience and knowledge anyhow. So if it is something totally new, and especially if it does challenge a very old and shop-worn tradition in your mind, then it's real tough for you to admit it into your head. For this they are willingly ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. He says in the last days would be people with a doctrine that everything goes according to cycles, including humankind, and that they are willingly ignorant of the Noachian deluge, willingly ignorant of the flood. And yet there is nothing more thoroughly proved, nothing with more evidence before your eyes constantly, day in and day out, than the Noachian deluge. But it's only evident to those who are observant. Now, you may not be a very observant person, and then again, you may be. It varies according to a person's natural inclination, perhaps, and their heredity and their environment, maybe their education. You may not know exactly the square footage in your home. You might not know how many steps up into your apartment. You might not be able to explain exactly what happens when you flip the switch on the wall. What the kind of an adapter would you take with you to Europe? Why do they have a different current? What's the difference between AC and DC? What's the difference between an ohm and a watt? What about a volt, and how does it occur that you get a jolt when you stick your finger into a wall plug? And why does it need to be connected? Why does it flow in a circuitous course? And where is the electricity ultimately? And where does it come from? What causes lightning? You could take a look at the cross-section of your home as you sleep away, and it ticks along there with all these gleaming gadgets doing the work for you while you're asleep. A little vial of mercury tilted at a certain angle, which is subjected to temperatures which can trigger an air conditioning unit. But if you could explain even simple household physics to your own children, you might be a little more observant person, so you would begin to know a little of the laws that cause erosion, the up-tilting of strata, the folding of strata, perhaps the upthrust of certain magma from underneath the surface of the earth. You would know a little about mountain building, a little about the erosion of streams, the fact that you're going to find bigger rocks and pebbles in the bottom and the deeply rushing part than you will the little smooth silt along the banks. And once you learn a few things like this, you'll become a little more observant in the great out-of-doors. And as you drive along a desert, you won't just see desert and wonder where the next soft drink can be obtained, but maybe you will begin to wonder how all that was formed, and you'll begin to see, because your eye will tell you there are natural laws that work upon it. And once you come to know the principles of these natural laws and the forces that act upon the earth, you cannot reconcile those natural laws with the explanations of so-called learned geologists and paleontologists. You just cannot do it. Now, I've been fishing along the southern reaches of the Colorado River. And for you people in Great Britain, if you've never been to the United States and you've never seen the Grand Canyon, it's a fantastic sight. Huge, steep, precipitous cliffs and a great, gigantic gorge in the surface of the earth that is 1 mile deep and about 19 miles across. And here's a carefully put together little model, and the geologist will try to tell you how this river gradually, over millions and millions of years, carved out this giant valley. Did it all by itself, the wind and the rain and the river. And they try to tell you the rate that that river is carrying silt today. And then they measure a series of years, and they've come to an average based upon winter floods and summer dry periods and so on. And then they try to tell you how many cubic yards or tons of silt it will carry, and therefore they can tell you the magnitude of its carving action upon the surrounding soil. And then they just wade back through history with it, and they try to tell you the age of the Grand Canyon. By this, they try to tell you the age of the strata that they find there. Now, it's funny that as you go along the southern reaches of the Colorado River, you will see huge conglomerates. Now, a conglomerate is merely a geological term for a certain kind of rock, which is a conglomerate, a mixture of rocks. All different types of rocks, a different, maybe, chemical analysis, different makeup, and also they can be volcanic or igneous in origin. They can be sandstone or They can be, in other words, sedimentary, or they can be metamorphic. It doesn't matter. But they were scoured and washed from someplace, jumbled all up together, and when you see them, they will be angular, sharp, some of them smooth and round and flat, and in all odd shapes and sizes, and from silt and sand right on up to huge boulders. Now, that's exactly what you find along the southern reaches of the Colorado River and along Lake Mojave. Great, huge sandbars and huge cliffs of this type of rock. Some of it as fine as pudding, like along Lake Mead. Some huge chocolate columns and spires rising up hundreds of feet, just like thick pudding. It was all mixed and swirled and laid down. Now, the thing about that that your eye will tell you is, even though it's hundreds of feet deep, it was all laid down at exactly the same time. That's a fact. You can see the swirls and the marks and the mixtures in it. And what do you do with a tree when it's standing up perpendicular through a whole lot of lines of strata? They try to tell you it was laid down over thousands of years. You and I both know what happens to a tree when it's exposed to rain and wind and summer heat all of that length of time. But even your natural eye will tell you with just casual observation based upon a few facts of knowing about nature that these theories won't, pardon the expression, hold water. Now, God Almighty, if there is a God, says in His Word, people scoff at the Noachian flood, that they take great exception to the flood. Now, I'll tell you why they do. Because if there was a flood, then it had to be universal in scope, and you can prove it was, and a great God brought it. And the story of Noah is not a story, but an absolute historical record. And there was a creation, and the entire shape and form of all of history, of ethnology, of biology, of every study known to man today would have to be subjected to serious alteration. That is a fact. And you would have to begin to pay attention to future statements such as Bible prophecy. One-third of the Bible is prophecy, and you would have to begin to pay attention to that and wonder what it says and what it portends for you. If you were to prove the Noachian deluge, all the rest of this would fall into place. Now, over in the first chapter of the book of Romans is a statement as a challenge to any atheist or agnostic that he can prove the things which you cannot see by looking at the material world, that you can prove the invisible God by looking at the physical material earth. He said in verse 19 of the first chapter of Romans, because that which may be known of God is manifest to them, for God has shown it to them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. It doesn't mean from the time element of the creation. It means by looking at the created are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Now to me, and I won't hide behind saying it's my personal opinion, I know based upon Scripture it's a fact, that of all people who have the least excuse for denial of God, it would have to be ornithologists, ichthyologists, biologists, chemists, doctors, medical doctors, especially pediatricians who deal with childbirth. And to see the marvels and the miracles of the human body and mind, to see human birth, to see the fantastic laws that act upon our physical material environment, and still to deny it had an originator, an author, a life giver, that it has a sustainer, that it had someone to create and to put all of his intricate harmony and to put this tremendous balance in nature that you see, is a very, very foolish denial indeed. Now to go back just for a moment and to talk about evolution, then to give you a few more of these fantastic, embarrassing questions about evolution. You know, evolution claims that the simple to complex came through natural selection by resident forces without any outside intervention whatsoever. Natural resident forces. Now, they never get around to explaining what causes those forces and what's so natural about them, but let's just understand how evolutionists explain animals evolved. Now, remember that they claim everything previous to animals existed by accident. But now you come to the real problem of the development of various species. I think the biggest problem of all is, where do they get the universe? I don't care whether you go with Moulton's theory or whether you go to the Big Bang theory or what. It doesn't matter which one you choose, whether the spiral nebulae or whether the Big Bang. By what law did one giant star approach another? What makes a star? What makes them burn? What is an explosion? What creates it? What are its effects? What causes particles to give off energy and light and to gradually cool instead of gradually heat? It could work the other way if you're dealing with an accidental universe. but they begin with a fantastic, complex universe of which the Earth is just a little dust in a limitless seashore called the Milky Way, which is, after all, only a galaxy, which is one of maybe billions, which make up the universe, which could be one of millions of universes, and it's so gigantic your mind cannot comprehend. And right quickly, in one or two paragraphs in the beginning of a history book, they will narrow down to how primitive animals developed into man. Primitive animals, so the story goes, became more complex as the rigors of their environment demanded. They gradually developed whatever they needed. Now, we don't see it happening today, but here they dodge behind the billions and millions of aeons of time. So they have a convenient scapegoat all the time. So an insect grew more specialized, a fish turned into a bird, or a reptile, like it's not, grew feathers and became a bird. A rodent changed into a higher mammal. And maybe even though apes did not change into men, many people mistakenly believe, and I think weaken their position by claiming to say that evolutionists claim apes developed into men. They claim nothing of the sort. They claim that primates had the same ancestors, that they sprung from a basic trunk. And the reason they do this is through comparative anatomy and comparative embryology and the skeletal structure, the muscular structure, and the outward appearance of some of these creatures. They line them all up sort of like a police lineup, and if they have any appearance that looks sort of similar, they think, well, one must have come from the other, or they came from a natural ancestor. The idea they both had the same maker would not occur to them. That they had a designer, had a basic pattern in mind, would not occur to them. Now, it occurs to you, if you look at a group of homes, you say, well, I wonder if that isn't designed by the same architect. You don't think one home came from another. But geologists have never reasoned this way, at least the average one. Now, they suppose that this all happened by natural selection or survival of the fittest. And yet, when you see the biggest problem confronting mankind today and compare that with what animals are doing about it, it is really quite an embarrassing question for evolution. The biggest single problem facing mankind today is that of the population explosion. Of man overpopulating the earth and coming to the point where he's worried about drought, about famine, about impending food wars, and they wonder, massive education could never be affected in time to solve the problem, and they say even if you could, people would not go along with what they're taught anyhow. They'd still act pretty much as a free moral agent. So they admit, it must be one of the biggest insoluble problems that man has ever faced. And yet, look at nature. I want to tell you a little bit about natural selection and a little bit about the stumbling blocks to it, about animal arithmetic, as it could be called. What would have happened when the common housefly was the most complex animal on Earth way back in evolution now as the housefly began to develop? Remember now, at this time, the fly would have had no natural enemies. He ruled the Earth. You know, they give you the story that each creature, one time or another, ruled the Earth. Finally, the age of fishes came along, the fish ruled the earth. Then came the age of dinosaurs, and they ruled the earth, and so on. Now, here's this little fly. He has no natural enemies. There are a few problems that I immediately see with that. He has no bodies in which to lay maggots, and therefore the fly didn't survive. But let's go on and forget about that. Flies have to survive because of rotting vegetable material animals in which to lay their eggs so that the maggots can become the larva stage, and finally they can become flies. But in only 6 months' time, the common housefly could explode to 191 quintillion flies from two parents. That's 191 followed by, let me see, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18 zeros. So line up 18 zeros behind 191, you got 191 quintillion flies. That would be enough to submerge the entire country of Germany under 47 feet of flies. They don't quite have that many even in Egypt, but that's a lot of flies. You'll have to admit that. 47 feet thick over the entire country of Germany. Now, there wouldn't be any toads around to devour these flies, no housewives with fly swatters or fly paper. The flies would rule the earth, and there wouldn't be any birds to slaughter them by the hundreds. And, of course, the story of evolution would grind to a halt just as it began, because flies would rule the world, and there wouldn't be anything else but flies. Now, the same thing would happen if your story began with the ant. Army ants have been known to attack every living animal there is, and they employ squads of army lynchers, which dismember everything from crickets to birds to mice to sheep to horses to elephants to man. And they can chew, pull, and tug at every part of the body until even a huge animal will finally collapse and be eaten. And he can't fight them off. They're just too many. Now, how ridiculous would it be to believe that evolution would continue after the army ant evolved and that he would rule supreme on the earth? I'm coming to something.
Now you take a fish. A codfish lays 4 million eggs per season. An oyster can produce up to 114 million eggs in one brood, and sunfish up to 300 million eggs a season. As soon as one of these fish evolved, it could pack the oceans, destroying all challengers, or else destroying itself, because what is it feeding upon? On land, mice would have done the same thing, because mice reproduce at a fantastic rate, 17 litters per year, and up to 10 in each litter. Without owls, foxes, and predators, without mouse traps and housewives with brooms, mice would rule the world. Now, each one of these animals and many others provides an insurmountable stumbling block to evolution, because these animals would halt the progress of their own species for all eternity. And here's the point. They never did rule the world. They all had to come into existence at precisely the same time in order to balance each other. Mice didn't rule the world. Dinosaurs didn't rule the world. Don't you know that the tracks of human beings and dinosaurs have been found in the same stratum? Oh, it's a fact. They don't like to admit that. I've seen a picture of it in an actual photograph in a textbook. It's a fact. Flies didn't rule the world. Foxes, birds, and toads didn't rule the world. The only possible answer is they all had to exist at the same time. What about microbes inside the digestive tracts of these creatures to keep them living? All animals today live in perfect balance. They have planned parenthood. A fantastic experiment with mice was done in a laboratory not too long ago, where they were allowed to reproduce as fast as they could. Plenty of space, ever-enlarging space, and plenty of food. They got up to a certain point and they simply quit reproducing. Something triggered something in the heads or the bodies of these little creatures, and they simply quit reproducing so that they did not explode. Lemmings, they just go on and on and on until somehow something gets into their little head and they all, at least giant hordes of them, rush into the sea and drown themselves. And the cycle begins all over again. They don't overrun other creatures. They don't rule the world. They kill themselves off in order to balance themselves and to control their own populations. There are fantastic facts about animal ecology, or population ecology, or animal arithmetic, which you should study into sometime and find out for yourself whether or not it makes a bit of sense to even remotely suspect that evolution could be true. Now, the evolutionists like to poke fun at the faith of theologians. You know, it's about time a lot of theologians and church-going people began to realize that evolutionists have a faith that is of such proportions and so empty, it is nothing short of embarrassing. It is the most gigantic and the most idiotic and the most unanswerable and the most untenable faith that could ever be hatched. They have to believe in nothingness beyond all proportion, and it's unbelievable that a person could ever swallow the idea of evolution. It really is, when you stop to really think about it, as I think few evolutionists ever have. Why don't you write in for these booklets, Does God Exist, and the Proof of the Bible, and look into it for yourself. And get your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine, where you will be receiving articles along this line every single month. And also write for the article on 7 Proofs God Exists. It's free of charge, no price. Now, there's another article, Why God Is Not Real to Most People. Here is an article explaining it, and how God can really be real to you, how you can get personally acquainted with Him. Write for the booklet, Does God Exist? The article, 7 Proofs God Exists, and this free article, Why God Is Not Real to Most People. Send your name and address to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. And so, until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.